On this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, I sit down with Jeremy Roll to uncover his 15 years now as a full-time passive investor.
Hey, Mavericks. This is Ava Baukamp, and this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks is brought to you by Legacy Impact Investors. We are an industrial investment firm located in cash flow country, the Midwest. We strive to shield off risk and beat inflation, all while producing predictable cash flow. We curate real estate investment opportunities for busy professionals and other real estate investors seeking passive income. To learn more about what we do and connect with me, go to www.legacyimpactinvestors.com.
Maverick, noun, unusual person, a visionary, leader, go-getter, an independent thinker. They see the vision for their life and pull that future towards them with an unyielding belief that things can and must be better. They achieve what most won't. Innovative, influential, daring, and direct, with a remarkably high tolerance for taking calculated risk. A foe to the status quo. This is Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks. Your host, Neil Timmons, has been involved with over $300 million in real estate transactions. He's a published author, commercial property investor, and real estate syndicator. This show is for those who want to learn how to earn passive income through real estate investing. Now, here's your host, Neil Timmons.
Welcome to Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, where we provide you actionable steps for you to grow your passive income and become job optional. During this episode, you're going to get to discover Jeremy's 15-year full-time career as a passive investor. Now, for those of you who are new, I'm your host, Neil Timmons. I love passive income from real estate. Now, before I introduce you to today's Maverick, I want to make a request that if you like what you're hearing, well, give us a thumbs up. Be certain to subscribe to the show. Never miss a valuable episode. And if you love what you hear, well, give us a written review. Plus, be sure to look at the written description here of the episode. We packed it with thousands of dollars in free resources. Now, today, we've got the privilege to learn from somebody who has been investing passively for 20 years. He retired and has been doing it full-time now for the last 15. Prior to his career in real estate, he was in the corporate headquarters of Disney. Ultimately, it all changed when he had that epiphany to get out of the stock market, got turned on to passive investing in real estate, and led him down the hole. Now, we describe today's Maverick as someone who's absolutely passionate about reading, consuming information relative to the economy and his investments. Today's Maverick, Jeremy Rolls, here with me. Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad you're here. Say, for the audience's sake, who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
Yeah. So my name is Jeremy Roll, located near Newport Beach in California. Originally from Canada, I spent half my life in Montreal where I grew up, been in the LA area for the other half of my life, with the exception of Philadelphia for an MBA. I did over 10 years in the corporate world, have an MBA from like the Wharton School from University of Pennsylvania. But in 2002, after the dot-com crash, I started to invest in alternative investments to get away from the stock market and more predictable type of investing. And I rotated all my money from stocks and bonds between 2002 and 2007 and got out of the corporate world in 2007 from the passive cash flow. So I've been a full-time passive cash flow investor for over 15 years, but doing it though for over 20 years, if you include the time where I was in the corporate world. So I'm kind of a full-time passive cash flow investor and LP investor.
That's incredible. Take me back to the very beginning. Tell me about your very first passive investment into real estate.
Yeah, I think it was in February of 2002. I had the luck of having lifelong friends of mine where I grew up in Montreal who had been syndicating for decades at that point. So they were very experienced and they focused mostly on office and retail, a little bit of industrial. And so I started investing with them actually from the US, but into Canada, just because it was someone I could trust. And also, probably equally as importantly, I wanted to learn from them, right? So I probably get a much better exposure to learning than with a typical syndicator type situation. So I started investing in that. I've had this question before. I can't remember the exact where it was or what it was, but I know it was in Canada because I went on to make a bunch of investments in Canada and then started going into the US. But it was way back in 2002, right after the dot-com crash.
Bring me current. Tell me about your most recent investment.
So, and you're talking about syndication investments.
Syndication.
Because I bought treasuries like last week. So
The most recent real estate syndication investment. Yeah.
Yeah. So the most recent syndicated real estate investment I think I made was within the past few weeks that was an ATM fund.
Oh, an ATM fund. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Tell me, between the first and the last, there's been a lot of learnings along the way. Fair to say?
Yeah, I've been in over 150 to 200 plus LLCs. So
give me the top 3, 4, 5 things that you've learned, the pillars that stick out in your mind over the last 20 years.
Absolutely. So when you're going a limited partner route, when you're passive, you are making a bet on a person. And my belief after all is that who you're making a bet on is even slightly more important than the property itself, which is a huge second important ranking. So who you're making a bet on could not be more important. And that's number one. Number two is that while this is not a must for me to have, it's a positive when I can have it. I've been in several scenarios where if there was like some type of temporary money needed for some reason, it could have been for tenant improvements on a retail or office property to actually add value, whatever it was. Having deep-pocketed syndicator who can actually come in and write a $1 million check because of their net worth, instead of having to do a capital call and writing it either a zero or low interest loan in that scenario, can be a huge help if and when it's needed. But you also have to make a bet on a person, even though they have the money, that they have the mentality that that's what they want to do. Because there are plenty of people out there who have the money who won't do it, right? Mm-hmm. So again, it comes back to who you're making a bet on. Another thing I'll say for sure is I always strive to get diversification across asset classes, geographies, and operators. And if you take a look at what happened with Madoff, which was highly unfortunate, that's obviously a huge understatement. If I had, you know, let's say I was investing in those types of money managers and I had diversified across 5 or 10 of them, then Madoff becomes a very big problem for some people, but it's not taking you down, right? And right. I feel like syndication investing is the same. And I think with syndication investing, because of the lack of liquidity, that diversification is even more important. And the diversification across asset classes and geographies can help you throughout different parts of the cycle. Some things are even counter-cyclical. So getting that diversification, it's not something I would tell someone to do within the first year or two, because you got to learn the asset classes slowly. But over time, I think that's absolutely critical and has definitely helped me in a big way. Those are some immediate, I mean, I can go through more, but those are the automatic immediate ones coming to mind.
So people's a big one. How do you vet somebody? What are you looking for when you're going through there? And how does it, ultimately, I'm asking, how does a limited partner, when they're evaluating somebody, what are they looking for?
Yeah, great question. So I would say high level, what I look for, because I'm a very conservative person. When I invest into something stabilized or may or may not have any value at upside, that's optional. Because I just want to go to sleep tonight, wake up tomorrow, and not much has changed because I live off the cash flows. I got into all this predictability over 20 years ago. It still remains the same today. And so I'm looking for someone who's conservative, just like me, who is going to have high level reserves, who's going to kind of under-promise to look to over-deliver for investors, to build long-term relationships with investors and have repeat investors. I am trying to avoid people who are aggressive, using really nice numbers, but have really nice marketing packages. But if you dig into the numbers, it's kind of obvious and apparent that they're aggressive. They're a marketing machine. They can attract a lot of investors. And so if you don't reinvest with them next time, they don't care, even if they've gotten your money. And so I'm trying to avoid that. And I'm also trying to match with my personality. So for example, I've invested with one sponsor I'm thinking of about 20 times, multifamily, and probably 7 or 8 out of 10 deals that they've sent to me, I've invested in because we're so much on the same page as far as being conservative, business plan, et cetera. That is the best match I can get, assuming they're very reliable and they're very experienced. So I'm also trying to avoid people who are absolutely brand new, because I know this is going to sound bad, but I concluded many years ago that if I'm investing with someone in their first or second or third deal, assuming they weren't partners with somebody else for many years or whatever it is, but brand new, they're learning off my money. It's just a fact of life. And they have to learn off someone's money, but I'd rather not be mine. I might come in on the 6th, 7th, or 8th deal once that process has taken place. So I'm looking for someone who's experienced. I'm looking for a diversified tenant base and an opportunity. And when I'm making a bet on someone, I'm trying to size up whether they're conservative and whether they're going to execute well. And one more thing I want to say is I have a 100% mandatory background check requirement. And I rarely hear that from people. I could swear maybe only one out of two, maybe LPs do it. I don't even think 2 out of 10 do it. I've had a background check service since I started, and it saved me multiple times, very obviously, when I've actually looked at some checks. And one of the ways I size up, I do many tests, but one test that I do is before I run the check, I'll say to them, I need your name, home address, and date of birth. And the truth of the matter is, especially if they have an uncommon name, I probably don't need anything but their name. But yeah. I'll ask them to see if they're hesitant to give it to me. And then I'll say to them, more importantly, is there anything I should know before I run this check? And sometimes someone will be upfront, this happened, this is the explanation, you're going to see it on there, right? But sometimes I'll see someone who, let's say, had a bankruptcy 10 years ago, assumes that it's wiped off because it was more than 7 years ago because it's wiped off their credit, but it remains on their actual background check.
Right.
And they conveniently forgot that very big highlight of their time. And so you can definitely glean a lot by testing people. I'll ask certain questions not to get the answer, but because I want to hear how they answer it to see if they're conservative or not. So there's a lot of stuff that I do in terms of reading between the lines because I'm determined what personality I'm making a bet on, which is really important.
All right. So they pass the test. Now you're onto the asset. What are you looking for inside of that asset, inside of that underwriting that's going to get you to go, all right, this is the deal that they put forth that I'm going to pull the trigger on?
Yeah. So I'm going to remind me at the end because there's one very simple thing I look for today that's keeping me on the sidelines for the most part on most assets. But as a generalization, I'm looking for someone who's using conservative inflation and expense assumptions in terms of increases, someone who is using a realistic exit cap rate, someone who is using an expense ratio that's realistic. I just got a deal the other day. Numbers look pretty good. It was like a 40% expense ratio on a Class C 1960s property. I think we both know right away. Yeah. I mean, I said that because it's obvious, right? But that's what they're marketing, right? And that's how the numbers are looking good. And that's how the cash flow is looking good. So I go line by line in some stuff because some sponsors will just use a multiplier of, let's say they use a 3% expense increase and a 3% revenue increase each year. Okay. But some of them will just literally copy and paste it across their Excel cells and move on with life. But some of them will actually go into the detail of breaking it down by, well, the health insurance costs tend to increase more than 3% each year realistically, so I'm going to do 5. The insurance increase is this much, so I'm going to do this much. And they actually start to tweak it. And that starts to tell you how detailed someone is, which can then, of course, impact how detailed they are looking at a property and actually trying to assess whether they should buy it to begin with. So this is what I'm talking about with the reading between the lines. You can start to look at a lot of details and glean a lot, actually, when you read between the lines. So high level, obviously, the numbers have to make sense. The location has to make sense. I tend to have a minimum number of units or tenants that I look for diversification. Each asset class is different, and I can give you some examples. So it has to hit that. I tend to stay away from either Class C properties or C areas. I tend to stay away from tertiary areas, but I also tend to stay away from very primary markets. So I won't invest in an office tower Class A in downtown LA. It's not my thing. It's actually a lot of people's thing, but it's not my thing. And so I created kind of what I call like a little box over time of what I'm really targeting so you can weed things out pretty quickly. But I just want to go back to what I said at the beginning, that what has kept me on the sidelines today as an investor, which I feel like a lot of people lost complete sense of in the last few years. And I, by the way, I did not invest in one floating rate bridge loan apartment deal, just to be clear, like even though that was almost everything that was available. But there has to be positive leverage for an investor. There has to be a risk premium for someone to invest. And the positive leverage historically is typically like 150, 200 basis points.
In the spread.
Right now, I'm still seeing negative leverage deals. In some loan assumptions, I'm seeing a decent amount of positive leverage, but it doesn't mean that they're not overpaying for the asset at the same time. So you have to differentiate those two. But I am basically seeing at best 20 to 40 basis points of positive leverage, which is the risk premium isn't there. And that's why I think prices still have to adjust.
Are you a passive real estate investor seeking financial freedom? Well, today's market's unique and it's ever changing. Now is the time to get educated on how to strategically invest in commercial real estate for long-term financial freedom. Grab your copy of How to Passively Invest in a Changing Economic Environment. Go to www.mavericksinvest.com. So for the audience's sake, in case they don't know what the risk premium is and the positive or negative leverage, it is, for example, I'll just do easy math. You're buying a property, it's 7 cap, right? And you can, well, let's call it 7.5 cap, and you're borrowing money at 7. And therefore, you've got positive leverage by 50 basis points.
Yes.
And you're saying, and I agree with you, that historically, you'd see about 150 plus or minus, maybe 125 to 175, somewhere in that kind of range in terms of historical positive leverage inside of a deal.
Yeah. And that, so when someone said to me, like, how do you know if you should invest today? Well, I'm going to put aside, like, I read about 2 to 3 hours a day, truly, of economic news to stay on top of what's going on from, like, are we going into recession, et cetera. But putting all that aside, the very simple equation is, if I'm not going to get the risk premium and the positive leverage, then I'm going to be on the sidelines because I know eventually it's going to revert to the mean. That's what has happened every single time. Hmm. And so if I don't wait for that time, I'm probably overpaying relative to the cost of financing.
What's your opinion on that? My opinion is, and I want to hear yours, is that in several of these cases, the debt is the winner in these scenarios. The debt comes out ahead. The debt is so high, they can request, as a result of how poorly levered everything is, meaning the spread, they can require 30, 40% down in many cases, thus putting themselves on a risk-adjusted basis in a terrific position.
Yeah, the debt is definitely in the driver's seat. There's absolutely no question. And it's interesting because I've heard over many years that If the bank is saying they're going to give you 50% loan to value when in normal times they give you 70% loan to value, they're typically not stupid and they're trying to tell you something, right? They're saying, we believe the price is probably going to come down and we have to get extra padding to protect from that. That's actually what that means. It's the bottom line. And so I agree. Like if they're getting into a 50% loan to value scenario, assuming that they don't believe it's going to go down more than 10 or 20% from here, they're in a very good position.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What are you looking for? Or maybe what has been some of the most positive GPs? What actions have they taken in their communication plan to you as an LP? You see this across the board with as much as you participated with various people. Who are some standouts? I guess, what actions have they taken to stand out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm going to answer this a little differently than you asked it, I think, because it's something I learned a long time ago. So when I started investing in syndications in 2002, I was working at Disney headquarters in Burbank in California. Okay. And I was used to getting all kinds of fancy decks and presentations and PowerPoints. We literally had a full-time person who you could actually send your deck to as a manager, and they would actually polish it up and fix the capitalization, like literally full-time, because that's how many decks we had going around, right, to management, everything else. So I was just seeing very polished things. And when I first started looking at some deals, what threw me off a little is I would go for the really professionally polished deals, and I would pass on the stuff that looked like a very not nice, like done, like they just didn't take the time. But what I learned over time is that I'd rather invest with someone with like the worst documents. And I don't mean like operating agreement doesn't have the right terms in it, it's not the right rules, but the worst investor facing documents, but the best execution, than the best documents and the worst execution, right? So when you're asking about communication, I'd still rather invest with someone with the best execution with the worst communication than the best communication and the worst execution. And that's kind of tricky, right? Because you want to have both.
Yes.
But if I had to choose, I would take the better execution. And so sometimes I have gotten frustrated when I've had great execution, but such bad communication and discussion with other LPs that we literally cannot invest again, even though they're performing so well. And that is like the worst shooting in the foot a sponsor can possibly do to themselves, right? Yeah. You have a great job on the ground, but such poor communication, nobody wants to deal with them again. And so I don't look for monthly reports necessarily. I think that puts almost too much of a burden. I'd rather them spend the time on the operations than reporting to me every month. Quarterly reports. I would say that to your point, though, it is very important that each person match their personality and their expectation to what they're going to get from a sponsor. So be sure to ask for a sample quarterly report of a real deal from the past from them, whether it's live or done deal, that you can see what to expect. Because there are a lot of investors who invest, don't ask, and then they're complaining that the report isn't detailed enough. The problem is, had they just asked for a sample, they already would know what to expect and whether they should have moved forward or not. So I'm not giving you the perfect answer to what you're asking, because I actually have a lot of tolerance for like not the most detailed report, but I also don't want like a three-liner, but I really strongly focus on the execution.
What are you most excited about this year?
Well, I would say I've been on the sidelines for a long time, except for very unique, I still do deals, right? So, but very unique situation. So what I'm excited for this year is that we're getting closer. And as the year goes on, we're getting closer to a time where there's going to be a green light for me again. And so I'm excited to be getting through the sun before the storm, so to speak. And I'm waiting for the storm to be able to get good deals again that is necessary to reset the cycle. So I'm also excited for the fact that the year is almost done at this point, recording this in August, just because I believe next year is going to bring some really good opportunities that haven't been around for a very long time.
I would agree with that. Let's do this. I want to move on to the final segment, what I call the final four. What do you think holds most passive investors back from hitting their personal next level, whatever that next level happens to be?
Well, I commonly see analysis paralysis, where someone new is trying to figure out which asset class to do. They'll actually put a lot of time into it. They'll listen to a lot of podcasts, they'll go to a lot of meetings, but they're almost like a squirrel just getting distracted. Self-storage, mobile home parks, RV parks, office, which one should I invest in, right? And so I always tell somebody, focus on one asset class first and one you can most easily understand right off the bat. If you lived in a mobile home park when you grew up, go invest in mobile home parks. You will have the lowest amount of education to do on it, and you will be able to transfer 80% plus of your knowledge across all the asset classes as a copy and paste. So I definitely find that that happens. And I would say that if I have to say the number one challenge I see that people have, new people, is that very often someone will come to me, they might be in the corporate world, they may have just exited a company, whatever it is, and they say, okay, I finally saved up enough money, what do I invest in, right? And obviously that's a great goal that they had and they got there. But the question isn't, okay, I have the money now, what do I invest in? The question is this the right time to invest and in what? right? Because the market is not here to just work for you. You have to actually sort out. So the thing that I find a lot of people don't do is ask themselves the question, is this the right time to invest to begin with? They just want to deploy the capital. And that can be very detrimental. So you really have to create your own opinion about that and determine if it's the right timing or not.
Outside of real estate, what are you passionate about?
Well, I got to be honest, I love startups. I just like the idea that someone's creating a new business and helping people. Yeah. I invest about 1% of my money in startups, 99% in passive cash flow, but I always find that very interesting. I also am a car guy. So as a quote unquote hobby, I just love cars and I work out every day. So I'm a big cardio guy. But honestly, I spend a lot of time focusing on real estate. I just do a ton of reading every day. So it's a lot of, I actually obviously have a passion for that too.
Coolest car that you own or have owned?
Coolest one?
Yeah.
Coolest car that I have owned, it was literally for like 2 months. So it was a very weird situation. It was an Audi R8. But honestly, the last four cars that I've owned that were like for a long time, including the current car I have that's 11 years old, is a BMW M3. So that's what I'm driving today.
Favorite book?
Well, two. I'm sorry to have to answer with two, but I always tell people Rich Dad, Poor Dad and Cashflow Quadrant by Robert Kiyosaki, read in that order though. Rich Dad, Poor Dad first, Cashflow Quadrant second. Be sure to read both. They're really fantastic mindset books.
Yeah. Favorite way to make an impact in the community?
My favorite way is actually having calls with people who just want to brainstorm, who may be new to this type of investing. I'm able to take my knowledge of over 20 years. I don't charge people. I just try to give back because I have the time. And I love that I'm able to help people. I also started a nonprofit in 2007. Now it's more than 15 years old, called For Investors by Investors here in California. We have public investor meetings with absolutely no sales pitch. That's why I started it, because I went to so many meetings prior to that with sales pitches. So we have over 30,000 registered members. I also help co-run a conference for over 5-6 years called Intelligent Investors Real Estate Conference. Again, no sales pitch. And all we care about is trying to break even on the conference. We're not trying to make money. Same thing with Foreign Investors. We've actually lost money with Foreign Investors by Investors every single year for 16 years, but we're helping people. So those are some of the ways.
Wow, that's incredible. This has been a great conversation. You are a wealth of knowledge. I know we could sit here and talk for hours because I can extract a whole bunch of things out of you instead of deals and deal sponsors. But say for people who want to find you, they want to follow you, they want to connect with you, where can they go? What should they do?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have a website. I'm not on social media. I'm very just under the radar, but I am on LinkedIn, mind you. But best way to reach me is through my email, which is jroll, J-R-O-L-L. At Roll Investments, R-O-L-L Investments with an S.com. So jroll at rollinvestments.com.
Details are in the show notes, everybody. Hear me? Thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening, whoever's on with us here, and I hope it was helpful.
It was great. See you next time. To our listeners, pat yourself on the back. You guys have made it to the end of the show, and most people never finish what they start. If you receive value from today's show, be sure to share it on LinkedIn, your Facebook page, or your social media platform of choice. Subscribe to never miss a valuable episode in the future. And if you found value in today's episode, give us a thumbs up with a positive review. If there's a particular topic you'd like to hear about, well, I want to hear from you. Shoot me a message on LinkedIn. The link to my profile is below in the show notes. You can connect with me there for more valuable content.